Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
It's NFL football by numbers time, and now after the last couple months, we have gotten out of the lineman and linebackers realm, and we have got the jersey number 80, the land of the wide receivers, and some defensive backs, and it's all coming up with Oz Davis in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com, your portal to positive football history, and we have the Football by Numbers series back once again, and we have left the land of the big boys, and we are entering in the realm of the wide receivers. Jersey number 80 is up tonight, and we have our friend Oz Davis of the Truly the Goats and the SHN Showcase podcast coming on with us. Oz Davis, welcome back to the Pigpen.
I should say also Game Film Podcast.
Oh, I forgot about that. That's Aaron is going to be he's going to be screaming at me.
the bi-weekly podcast, which reviews a threesome of films every week. I don't really want to say a trilogy because they're not trilogies, but a triad of films every week. We try and focus on one sport every episode. Comes out about every 2 weeks.
All right. Well, what do you have coming up next? What's your next podcast coming on? What movies are we going to be watching or hearing about?
The next one. Wow, I should give spoilers. Well, we just came off of the Olympics, so we just did three movies about the Olympics. Next time, we are going to be doing wrestling, professional wrestling. No joke. Should I give you the titles? Of course, we'll be doing I will.
But hey, that way the listeners can maybe want to watch the movies and follow right along.
That's right. Well, we'll try and whet your appetite if you haven't seen it. We'll critically review it if you have. First one up, of course, since my partner Aaron Harris is a total film noir junkie, the first movie will be Requiem for a Heavyweight. I guess it's the 50s classic black and white film starring Jackie Gleason and, one of these star-studded casts. It's a, well-acclaimed movie.
Jackie Gleason is a wrestler in a movie?
No. He's like the crooked promoter, right?
So basically,
the kick of the film is it's a heavyweight boxer. He's kind of a bum. He's kind of washed up. And Gleason, who's his manager, keeps betting on him, which is, absolutely insane, right? Because obviously you're going to bet against your guy and make him take a dive. But, so he loses a lot of money and convinces him to go into professional wrestling. So next up on the docket, of course, is the classic 2014 Mickey Rourke movie, The Wrestler. It's 2014, which is just a brilliant, excellent movie on so many levels. I mean, it's just a great film. And finally, there's the shiny, happy, Fighting with My Family. Yes, Fighting with My Family. I think it was a 2020 release movie. A true story, based on a true story about, I don't know the actual wrestler. I don't recognize her, but she comes from Britain, where her parents were both, very low-level pro wrestlers, kind of like backyard wrestling kind of types. And her brother, who also aspires to be, of course, a WWE wrestler like she does. And it tells their story through the WWE. And it's a little bit like how in the 90s we had all those movies about guys who worked in the NBA or coaches of the NBA, or even like a player once in a while. And the NBA would actually supply players and games and stuff like that. It's kind of like that for WWE. You get a lot of cameos, a lot of behind the scenes stuff, what it's like to go through the program and all that kind of stuff. You know, plot wise, it's kind of shiny, happy, really predictable, but it's a nice look at, you know, how you make it in pro wrestling. So in that respect, it's quite interesting. But for more, tune in to episode 4 of Game Film, which will be out, I'm not sure when, probably the last week of August.
Okay, so be out shortly after this this podcast.
Sure.
Here, so
sure.
Nice. Okay, we'll have something to look forward to on that. Well, yeah. I mean, that's a good little breather to take before we get into this, because we're going to be talking about some major careers at the receiving position tonight. And this is probably one of the big numbers of the receivers, jersey number 80. And as we always start off, we always want to talk about who the Pro Football Hall of Fame recognizes wore jersey number 80 and is in the Hall of Fame. So in no particular order, we have Jack Butler, Isaac Bruce, Chris Carter, Tom Fears, Len Ford, Steve Largent, James Lofton, Jerry Rice, and Kellen Winslow Sr. Would you like to talk about any of those to start off with, or do you want to talk about the guys that are not yet in the Hall of Fame?
Yeah. Wow. All right. Can I die on the hill? Can I start by dying on the hill? Okay.
No, yeah.
All right.
We can start with
the tops. Here we go. This is like a test. This is like a pilot for an upcoming episode of Truly the Goats. All right.
Okay.
I want to try something with you and your audience here. Okay. Rule number two of Oz Davis's rule number two of goatdom is what I call the Donald Bradman. Okay. Now, Donald Bradman was a cricketer he played on the international level from the late 20s through the 40s, basically. Played 21 years on that level. Now, okay, I'd like to start off by asking, okay, Darren, do you know anything about cricket?
About
cricket at all? Okay.
It's like a baseball for the Europeans, I guess, is the closest thing I can say to it. I don't know.
Well, for the British Empire.
Okay.
More precise to say. Well, okay. Great. I'm glad because it's the Don Bradman rule. So let me throw this at you, okay? Put simply, cricket, unlike in baseball, when as a batsman, when you get a hit, you stay at bat in cricket, okay? You stay at bat and you're basically accumulating runs, okay? What we might call either runs scored or runs batted in baseball, okay? Until you're bowled out or thrown out or whatever. Okay, to get 100 points is called a century, and that's noteworthy, right? That will make the news. That will make the write-up for the game if you get that. Doesn't happen that often. Okay, so in 21 years playing international test cricket, from 1928 to 1948, Don Bradman averaged 99.94 runs per time at bat. Okay, the next nearest are these two other Australian guys in the 21st century, who went for 61.87 and 61.80 in 2 years and 13 years plus. He's still going. Incidentally, that's Steve Smith. So Steve Smith is a great two-sport star. He played football and international cricket. Great athlete there. But in any case, the point here is that Donald Bradman played for 21 years and is 40% better than the number two. Okay? That's domination. Okay. That's domination. Yeah. Do you agree? Okay. You don't know anything about cricket. Okay. Let's talk about football. Now, in football, everyone wants to proclaim Tom Brady the GOAT. Okay. But how about Jerry Rice? I'm still with Jerry Rice. Okay. Rice retired with 22,895 yards receiving. Okay. Probably the key stat for a receiver. Okay. At the time of his retirement, the next nearest was Tim Brown, who retired the same year with 14,934. At that time, he was 34.8% lower than Rice at number one. Okay. Nowadays, you know, post the 16-game schedule, post the pass happy rules that are now in place. Right now, the number two all time is Larry Fitzgerald. He has 17,492. That's 23.5% lower. Okay. Brady has not dominated like this. Okay. Now, even if you want to say Brady's career achievement is Super Bowl wins, well, hey, I mean, he's got seven. Yeah, sure, he's the all-time. Yeah, he's the GOAT in that. But Charles Haley won five Super Bowls. There's 12 other guys who won five NFL championships of some sort. There's three guys who won six, including Fuzzy Thurston and Forrest Gregg. Well, those are names. I mean, right. You know, even if you want to say an individual can win the Super Bowl, Brady is still only ahead by 14.3%. Jerry Rice is the greatest football player of all time. I'm Oz Davis, and this is Truly the Goats. Theme music?
Yeah, okay, all right. You make some good points there. Now, I would say Tom Brady is the GOAT of quarterbacks because of his championships, because I don't even think any quarterback has even touched seven championships. Even though you said, you know, even if you go back to the NFL championships, maybe the Packers have, you know, maybe a Bart Starr. I'm not even sure how
Bart
many
Starr has five.
So he's not really close to what Brady is, and Brady's still going. Who knows? He could get one or two more. You don't know. We got a pretty good team this year coming up, and I would say Rice is the greatest of all time at the wide receiver position. No doubt about it. You know, just like I would say, you know, I'd say Jim Brown is probably the greatest of all time at running back, even though he doesn't have the stats. It's just he dominated his era so completely. Yeah.
The other guy you talk about is Lawrence Taylor, for example.
Oh, absolutely, you know, absolutely.
Here's another guy who's possibly the greatest football player of all time. You know, if you want to put them all in the same pool. So you have to say, you know, he's best, you know, defensive player, if you want to say that. You know, Aaron Donald, by the time it's said and done, you know, it's going to be in this discussion, I think, as well. So,
I mean you know, you could look at it. You could look at it another way if you want to say greatest of all time. Maybe the guy that put professional football really on the map. You know, Red Grange. You know, he could be considered greatest of all time. I think there's many greatest of all times. It just depends what category or position you're looking at. I don't know if we can sit there and say the greatest football player of all time, because it's different eras, different positions. They have different jobs. You know, different tasks that they're meant to do. Even the receivers back in 1950 don't do the same things that Jerry Rice had to do in this era.
Yeah, so. It's a sport of great specialization. But I think that Tom Brady is the one that really drove me over the edge with the whole GOAT thing. It wasn't even so much Tom Brady. It was the fact that there was this interchange between Manning and Brady like every week. And folks were going back and forth. Who's the greatest of all time? Da-da-da-da-da-da. And then, you know, for a little while, it was Breeze. Is Breeze the greatest of all time? It's like, come on, guys. Look at Rice over here. Look at Rice. He was ahead of his time. He's still ahead of our time, for God's sake, you know? So,
believe me, I don't like to say that Tom Brady is greatest of all time. I'm a Steelers fan. I think the Steelers beat him once in their career, you know, in his whole career, or twice, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, he dominated the Steelers, and we had some pretty good teams. I mean, it's coming into Pittsburgh with Steelers, you know, I think it's the first year, the AFC Championship game. You know, the Steelers were supposed to clean his clock, and he did it. Believe me, I don't like saying it, but it's a fact. The dude won seven championships, and he played in 10 or whatever, you know, so it's... He's brilliant.
Okay.
But this is about Jerry Rice, because this is what we're talking 80. So
Jerry, what can you say? I mean, again, he's the reason why I started with Bradman is he's on that level of domination. I mean, he was so dominant for so long. And again, like his stats, the game today has still not caught up to his stats. I mean, it's just that's a GOAT. That's a generational athlete. He had no peer. Yeah, don't appear. We're going to talk a bunch of 80 great wide receivers that were number 80. Dude, none of these guys compare to Rice. Just awesome.
Yeah, I mean, just looking at how many years he wore the number 80. I mean, for a wide receiver in a National Football League, 2 decades, 20 years, the man played professional football at its highest level and played well. I really don't think he, I mean, maybe his last year it dove off a little bit from his numbers in the middle of his career, but, you know, he played on two different teams, two different offenses that final year, but he still was, you know, 400 some yards that last year. So,
I mean, football defies statistics, but Rice defies that trend of football. You know, I mean, in so many other sports, you can say stats don't lie. You can't do that in football, but geez, stats don't lie with Jerry. You know, so what is this? 5 consecutive all pros twice? 10 out of 11 years he was all pro? I mean, that's ridiculous. That's a career for most guys. And
right.
Still going on for what? 6-7 more years, by 7 more years in which he played almost every game. It's like, there's just no comparison. You know, there's no rival for this guy. This is like Jordan times, you know, 3 or 4. You know, it's just incredible. It's just incredible.
Yeah.
When we say GOAT, we should be talking about guys like Jerry Rice. We should. We overuse that term, which is one of the precipitators of my show. But I mean, geez. You don't even – like I'm calling up my pro reference – my pro football reference page right now. And I'm not even focusing on the page. And you just look at the bold. And the bold indicates when he led the league. You know, and you can just right. – they're just popping out at you like a 3D map. You know,
yeah, half of his stats are bold. You know? Right. It's crazy.
Right. I mean, it's just wow. I mean, generational athlete. For all you young whippersnappers who never saw him play, wow, you missed something. Really? This guy would be a stud.
And he came out of Mississippi Valley State. I mean, it wasn't Alabama or Ohio State or Michigan. Mississippi Valley State. How did college recruiters not see with this guy, see the potential in this guy? Crazy. Crazy.
Yep.
You know, and I'm not even sure. I think he wasn't even that high of a draft pick. I don't have that number in front of me. I should have.
Oh, gee. Yeah. Was that still in 85? Is that still in the days when there's a crazy number of rounds in the draft?
Yeah, there was like 12 rounds or something, right? I think. Yeah. Something that, you know, people were there for like 3 weeks drafting.
No. First round.
Oh, he was a first round. Okay. So
yeah, number 16.
So Bill Walsh and company, they saw the talent of this guy. Yeah, okay.
Something. Let's see. I just want. Oh, I'm not calling up the draft. I you wonder who was taken ahead of this guy.
Yeah, it's I mean, but his first year out as a rookie, 927 yards, 49 receptions, 3 touchdowns. Not bad for a rook. You know, almost 1,000 yards receiving and only 3 touchdowns. And that was probably – it had to be Joe Montana then, because I think he came in like a couple years earlier than that. You know, then the play with Steve Young, you know, and Joe Montana at the same time, then Steve Young, and then go to the Raiders, play with Rich Gannon. I mean, this guy had 3 stud quarterbacks, you know, 3 pretty good arms that were tossed into him, both from the right side and the left side. Caught the ball spin in both ways.
Again, and we can say this in football a lot. You know, this is another thing about the Brady myth is like, where does Brady stop and Belichick begin? Right. And, you know, we've got a little bit more of an idea of that now, but who would have given him a break? Well, the same thing goes for Rice. I mean, like, he is the benefactor of Walsh, you know, and that system, you know, the revolutionary passing system that he had in San Francisco. I mean, you're talking about him, like, breaking out for 900 yards in his rookie year. That's because he was, like, the number 4 option. Right. I mean, as a rookie. Right. I mean, that's how pass happy that system was. And this to me, this is another thing about goats in football. Football is just not an individual sport. It's not. It takes certain factors like that. Look, one of the reasons why Peyton Manning was so awesome I mean, he was going to be awesome no matter what. But the fact that he had Jeff Saturday, you know, it was one of the three or four greatest centers of all time, handing him the ball and never muffing a snap in like 12 or 13 seasons is like, that's part of the Manning mystique. Is it not? Mm-hmm. The fact that he was coached by Tony Dungy is part of the Manning mystique, right? And that's the thing about football. So Rice is also benefiting from his environment, which is perfectly natural.
And you could tell Manning was really missing Jeff Saturday from the Colts as a center when he got to the Super Bowl with the Broncos and it fired the first snap over his head. I kind of made a statement for that game.
that set the pace for the Broncos. Right. The last really great blowout in the Super Bowl, huh? Seattle Denver. They crushed them. That was not even funny.
Right. I felt like a lot like a playoff game last year that I watched with my Steelers. Snap over the head of the quarterback in the end zone. That's brutal when that happens. I after this year, I sympathize with the Broncos fans in that Super Bowl.
That will never make the Steelers all-time DVD highlight reel. That's for sure.
No, that's for sure. That's for sure. All right. Well, I think we're probably in agreement. Jerry Rice goes number one on the list without any contenders. You know, we could probably just have a one-person list and show's over and we'd be done with it. Had a great show. But we want to find nine other gentlemen here to join him on these greatest players. We're number 80. So who do you want to talk about next?
I was looking at this list, and when you give us the prep list for these shows, they're listed in order of AV, the stat over there, Pro Football Reference, which is kind of like a war in baseball. And I was amazed at how many towards the top are guys from, you know, the 80s, right? Our youth, right? I mean, I remember when we were kids. Okay, so, I mean, like number two on the list, far, far behind Jerry Rice, what a surprise, is Kellen Winslow. And damn. In the 80s, if you were a kid especially, what was more exciting than Air Korea? I mean, seriously, San Francisco was gorgeous, right? And, you know, the teams we just talked about, they were gorgeous. But, geez, San Diego was so much fun. I mean, these guys would go for 50 a game. You know, these guys were the scoreboard spinners of the 80s. And they were, they had Dan Fouts was your quarterback, and he was thrown to Winslow, and he was thrown to Charlie Joyner. And all three of those guys are in the Hall of Fame. You know, they also had John Jefferson there. He was awesome for a few years. It was just, again, they had four or five options. This was kind of like it was kind of like the greatest show on turf. Before that happened, it was just similar. Their defense was just – it was even worse than that greatest show on turf defense the next year after they won the first Super Bowl because, wow. I mean, the problem with them scoring 50 points is they were giving up 40. And Winslow was the benefactor of the Eric Oriel offense, of Dan Fouts' ridiculous arm in those years. And they were just great. They were just great. Right. You imitated them on the playground, right? Like on Mondays. It's just like, here's Dan Fouts. You just crank it for like 80 yards. Of course, being on the East Coast, and of course you were in the East too, and you remember how it was in those days. You took what they gave you. You took what they gave you on the TV station. So we rarely got to see these guys. But whatever you did, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, besides the playoffs, I think on the East Coast, the only game I can remember watching the Chargers was the Holy Rollers game. That's only because they were playing Oakland, and it came. I think they just cut away from the game we had in the East and went to that Holy Roller play because it was like, you know, they were inside the five with, you know, little time left and everything. That's the only time I really remember watching the Chargers except for like a playoff game. You heard about them, but we didn't have ESPN and everything to watch and see highlights on or go to YouTube. You're right. We didn't see it very often except the George Michael Sports Machine. How's that show for a throwback? Remember that one?
Flashback! Yeah. But basically, for the whippersnappers out there, okay, today, you still have it where you have like two games on Fox or two games on CBS and then one game later on Fox and CBS, right? And then you have the night game on NBC. But right. You also have Red Zone. You also have, you know, NFL Network, so you can pick your games, whatever. Okay, when we were kids, same thing, except without all that extra stuff. So you still right. got the two plus the one, right? And right. so – and that's what you got. And you got – basically, it was like one half owned the NFC and one half owned the AFC. And mm-hmm. so – you were probably seeing Pittsburgh every week. We were seeing the Patriots every week in New England. And then you'd get the NFC game. That would usually be like the Giants, right? Or right. the Cowboys, because they were ostensibly America's team and playing in that Eastern time zone. And then you'd get, you know, random for the second game from the West.
Right.
So right. it'd be wherever they wanted to show you that week. It's probably a rotation. They probably had it on rotation, so that was fair, right? But
yeah, but usually the 4 o'clock game was the Cowboys. So somehow they always end up in the 4 o'clock game. That's
they're trying to sell us on that America's team thing. Kind of a hard sell at Pittsburgh.
Right. But. Right. Yeah, we were debating that here in Western Pennsylvania. but what Winslow, I mean, what a career he had, you know, it spanned for a good long time too. He wore that jersey number for 9 seasons, which is pretty good for a tight end. You know, he 5 times a Pro Bowler, 3 times all pro, all 1990s decade team. I'm sorry, 1980s decade team. Just a tremendous career, 45 touchdowns from the tight end position. He really sort of revamped what that tight end was. It wasn't the big bully, you know, extra tackle in the block. He was a guy that had a set of hands, too. You know, even amplified what Mike Ditka and some of his folks like that did earlier. But
well, in the late 70s, early 80s, you had this first envisionment that the tight end could do this, right? You had Dave Casper.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Right. Casper could throw the blocks and he could catch and he could run. he was mm-hmm. quite good at running after the catch. And so that was the first envisionment of it. But I mean, again, Winslow, here you go. Here's another guy ahead of his time. Right. He's a tight end that you expect to see today. Right. Not much blocking. But, you know, again, he was the first option for Fouts most of the time. You know, most of these years.
Right.
You know, so it's like, you know, he was a modern tight end playing in the 80s, a generation and a half ahead of his time. Pretty good. Pretty good.
Right. All right. So do we agree he should be number two on our list?
Absolutely. Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Although here you go. Right. Here you go. Your next two guys are guys in the same mold, except they were playing on bad teams. Right. And that was another thing that struck me is how many of these guys were on bad teams. These next two guys would have been great fantasy guys. Because, like, you know, great stats, bad teams. James Lofton and Steve Largent. Which do you like better? I'll defer to you. Which do you like
better? Well, I would say Lofton because he had 2 more years. I mean, Lofton wore the jersey for 16 seasons, Largent for 14 seasons. Lofton on, what, 2 different teams, I believe? And, you know, at least 2, Green Bay and Buffalo. And Largent, I think, was pretty much... Largent came from another team early on, but he was mainly a Seahawk for his career.
Was he? Oh, I thought he was one of the original Seahawks. Because he played for them in 76, didn't he?
Oh, well, maybe he did. Maybe I might be thinking of somebody. Maybe I'm thinking of Zorn. I know one of those guys came from another team in the expansion draft, but it has him down for Seattle's entire career, so I stand corrected.
He's an original Seahawk, and never went anywhere else, never played anywhere else, even though he's from Oklahoma, but never left Washington State during his whole professional career. Went back home to Oklahoma and became a conservative representative in the U.S. House, actually for that state. But later on, after his career, let's see. Again, both of these guys were fascinations when you were a kid, right? And both of them were on these incredibly losing teams. You know, now this is back when Green Bay, you know, wasn't what do they call that now? Title Town? you know, for a couple of decades there, they didn't throw around title town Green Bay, Wisconsin so much. They were really mediocre for a long time. Who gave James Lofton's induction speech? Do you know?
No, I don't.
It should have been Lynn Dickey, because my God, you know, here's Lofton going for really the only option on these Packers teams. You know, what is it? 4 times in 5 years going for at least 1,200 yards, twice breaking 1,300, once going 1,294. And, you know, again, Lynn Dickey's his quarterback. Now, once Lynn Dickey wasn't throwing to James Lofton anymore, he was OOF. He was out of football pretty soon thereafter. This is how – I mean, like, again, Lofton was a stud. There was a big fish in a small pond. I mean, how many – we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, Jesus. 6 consecutive Pro Bowls. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And 7 out of 9. No, 6 consecutive, 7 out of 8. 7 out of 8 years he made the Pro Bowl, his first 8 years. Yeah, nice. And once All-Pro. Nice. Yeah, again, like the fact that we knew this guy, despite being on the afterthought Packers, was just, you know, to me, that speaks for itself. And again, in the 80s, another big stat guy from the 80s. Gotta love it.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll put you want to put Lofton 3?
Sure, Lofton's in there. Stat guy.
Okay.
And Largent for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, now here's a little story. I thought he played for another team. And I looked this up as we were talking here.
Okay.
He, in the 1976 NFL draft, he was picked by the Houston Oilers, 117th overall. And after 4 preseason games, he was called in by Bum Phillips and told that they were trading him because he really couldn't offer anything to the team. So they traded him to Seattle in sort of like an expansion draft type. I think that's when Seattle's first year was. So he never played a regular season game with the Oilers, but he was drafted by the Oilers, played their whole preseason there, and was drafted. And because Bum Phillips said, you know, really couldn't help them out very much. You know, we can't have an All-Pro receiver on here. We're shipping you off to the Great Northwest. So I think that's probably one of Bum Phillips's big regrets, I'm sure. But for Lord,
yeah. I mean, it certainly felt like this guy was carrying the team sometimes, because again, he wasn't playing with great quarterbacks. I mean, everybody loved, you know, Zorn because he was small and he was lefty. So of course, as kids, we all thought he was great playing with these plucky Seattle Seahawks, you know, but in reality, not that great a quarterback. Now, here's Largent. He played 14 years for this team, and only twice did they have a record better than 9-7 in those years. And in one of those years, they had 11 wins or 10 wins, and they didn't make the playoffs. So it's like, and the other key to those Seahawks teams, the limited success that they did have, was that, you know, Chuck Knox came over and coached them for a long time. And once he got on board, I mean, again, like, it's tough to say Largent really took off, but he was even better after Knox started coaching the team. And I think it's no coincidence that, you know, they made the playoffs 4 times in 7 years, you know, yeah, while he was coaching.
Yeah, but people don't remember, actually, Largent's whole career with Seattle, they were in the AFC West too.
Yeah.
So they weren't even an NFC team yet until like 92 or 93 when they did realignment.
Well, so you remember that they did that kooky thing where they started the first year the Seahawks were in the NFC. And then Tampa Bay was in the AFC, and they played every team in the AFC once. That was their schedule. They threw away like all other considerations, right? And Seattle. That was the 14th game. So they played Seattle. And then the next year they switched them. And Tampa Bay was back in was in the NFC. And Seattle was in the AFC. And then what? Did Seattle switch when Houston came into the league in 2002? Or When did they switch the NFC?
I think it was 95 when they went from two divisions in each conference to three divisions in each conference. When Jacksonville and Carolina came in, I think 90s, oh. Maybe it was 95. They totally realigned a lot of the divisions. Mm-hmm. And they remember, because, well, I can't say that. No, they had, because they had five. The Jaguars were actually in the AFC Central with Pittsburgh, and there's five team divisions. So maybe it was the late 90s they did it. When they said, okay, hey, this is kind of dumb to have, you know, five teams in one division and four in another. We got to shuffle this up. You know, that's probably when they brought in the Browns came in, the new Browns. Maybe it was in that era.
Yeah, because the Browns came in the resurrected Browns. That was 2000, I believe. And then the Texans came in 2002, because for a year or two, there was 31 teams. And they had two bye weeks. Those years, teams got two bye weeks because of the weird kooky schedule. That was kind of 31 teams.
Yeah. Right.
So yeah, so that must have been it. So yeah, so again, kiddies, back in the day, for a long time, Seattle was playing with Oakland and the Oakland Raiders, remember them, and the San Diego Chargers, remember them,
and
yeah, exactly, and Kansas City, and who am I forgetting?
Denver Broncos.
Yeah, there's still the Denver Broncos. Okay, great. Yeah, but in any case, Largent was, I mean, he seemed, you know, again, as a kid, he seemed like he was about 6'7" out there, you know, and always with the high jumps. He could catch just anything, just led the league in receiving a few times. And just, wow, just seven all pro teams, not Pro Bowl, all pro. I mean, it was just, wow. Largent was just awesome. Just awesome. He was one of my favorites.
Yeah, yeah. Guy always, I don't know if he ever got the ball thrown at his chest. There's always, like you said, he's stretched out. I mean, Zorn and Dave Craig, his later quarterback, you know, they're putting him up high for this guy who's only 5'11", you know.
Yeah.
He had some big quarterbacks back then, too. Right. He's grabbing everything, like the San Francisco 49ers playing in the back of the end zone. That's how Largent had to catch every ball. So he's very exposed to cornerback just ripping his rib cage out, you know.
Oh, yeah. Far less protective league. And I don't think he ever, until he got old, until later in his career, I don't think he ever had any serious injury of any sort.
No.
He took some hits, right there. But he always got back up. So, I mean, just right. Largent, he was just a bat. Just for the whole heat. He's just a badass. Really great player.
All right. Yeah, definitely. So, okay, so that takes us four. Adding Lofton and Largent on there, that's four of our top ten. And we still have some Hall of Famers to go through, or we can put anybody in there, whoever you want to go to next.
Okay, because we've got a couple of exceptions here. We've got like a two-way player and a cornerback, who I'm sure you're dying to talk about because that was from the very bad Pittsburgh Steelers days. But I mean, should we throw in more wide receivers?
Well, I think the AV's off a little bit because I think I would probably put Chris Carter up in that next echelon of receivers.
Yeah,
that's what you're thinking.
Yeah,
yeah, I agree. Carter should be up there.
I was thinking Carter, and I mean, you know, again, Carter's kind of on mediocre teams. There's some of these Vikings teams make the playoffs. Some of them are competitive, but. For me, you know, the longevity is big here, just along with the typical statistics. I mean, between 91 and 2001, he missed four games. I mean, okay. So basically, what Steve Largent was to the 80s, Carter is to the 90s, right? And just like Largent, he's in eight straight Pro Bowls. I mean, you know, that's quite a run. So yeah, Carter, again, he's in that mold of just, you know, just unbreakable wide receivers.
No, only Carter's 4 inches taller and outweighs Largent by 20 pounds. So he's a big man for a wide receiver in that era.
But it was a decade later.
Right.
You know, I think people are starting to smarten up in the 90s. I think this is when, you know, in all sports. Have you noticed this? You don't get, like, for example, in baseball, you don't get the fat guy relief pitcher anymore. You know, you rarely see – even the so-called fat guys in football are often, you know, again, 50, 60 pounds bigger than they used to be, you know, in the 80s. And I think this really starts happening in the 90s. I think weight training becomes a part of, for example, the basketball player's regimen in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's why guys like Carter, and we're going to talk about Isaac Bruce, were just a lot more built than, you know, even the guys in the 80s were just a lot stockier. And just a lot bigger at the shoulders and such. So, you know, but which is not to say that Carter was not an impressive physical specimen for his time, because he certainly was. But I just think that Carter is a reflection of that change period.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, what a great career he had too, though. 8 Pro Bowls, twice an All-Pro, all 1990s team. 1999, wasn't the Walter Payton Man of the Year, the NFL Man of the Year, I guess it was called back then. Did great for his community, did great for his team. Minnesota Vikings for majority of his career, but he started off as a Philadelphia Eagle, which I sort of forgot about, 87 through 89 in Philadelphia, and was Minnesota for 12 seasons after that, and then finished his career in Miami. So, you know, got around the country here pretty good when playing some of these pro teams, but pretty good receiver. You know, another one, almost 14,000 yards. You know, it's
awesome.
These guys are putting up the yardage on these receivers wearing number 80.
Yeah, he's
130 touchdowns.
He's in a line of great Vikings receivers, right? They cranked out a few decent receivers over the years.
Yeah, he teamed up with Randy Moss for a while there too, and Moss was the first couple years in the league.
That's a great twosome. Of course, you've got one guy from the all 90s team, and you've got one guy from the all odds team. But so you're kind of catching them at the wrong points in their respective careers. But that's quite a duo. It's hard to believe that they never got to the Super Bowl. Oh, wait, it's the Vikings. Okay.
Yeah.
I understand.
Well, the other thing, there was another great receiver that was in that room also. A young Larry Fitzgerald was the ball boy for those Minnesota Vikings teams. Those were his idols.
Wild.
I think the story, Fitzgerald's father was on the coaching staff for those Vikings teams. He was an assistant coach of something. And he spent all his time with Carter, and when Randy Moss came on, a couple of the other receivers there. But Carter really took him under his wing and taught him the craft, you know, and taught him how to catch a ball. You know, have the soft hands, and went to Pitt, and you know, the rest is history in the NFL. But yeah,
he might be the Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald might be the GOAT ball boy of all time.
He might be.
Got that tutelage and became the number two receiver of all time. That's fantastic. Wow, I never knew that. That's a hell of a trivia item. That's fantastic. That's great. Thanks. Thanks for that.
Yeah, no problem.
I like that.
But so they had a pretty good receiver room, even though one of them couldn't play yet. I think Carter with those numbers, I think he's got to go 5 on our list here.
Sure.
And you started mentioning another guy that had some long tenure at wide receiver, 14 seasons for Isaac Bruce.
Isaac Bruce. Yeah. Well, he's another one of those guys. There are certain teams, like we talked about this before. I've appeared on podcasts before. If you talk about those great Browns teams of the 50s, or, you know, Curly Lambeau's Packers or anything, you know, there's often not a lot of game film on these guys or stats, you know, or whatever. But, you know, they played with those teams, so you can't really disparage them. And Isaac Bruce is one of those. You can't disparage anyone from the greatest show on turf, I think. And, you know, even if you only have that one highlight moment in this guy's career, he might crack this list, which is, you know, the game-winning touchdown in Super Bowl 34, the 73-yarder to put the Rams up 23-16, and that was it. You know, it was just like, wow. Mm-hmm. You know, based on that alone, based on that one season, or let's be fair and say that three-season run. You know, all of these guys are going to make all of these lists. You know, Kurt Warner, Marshall Faulk, Torrey Holt, Isaac Bruce, all of those guys. Again, just a guy that I love to watch, you know, as a fan.
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, it was just less than 2 weeks ago. I was in Canton at Tom Benson's field, and there's Isaac Bruce getting his gold jacket.
Nice.
Kurt Warner's there to congratulate him, wearing his gold jacket. You know,
all right.
That was quite a great thing to see him. You know, Isaac Bruce. I mean, who couldn't love the Greatest Show on Turf? Like we talked about earlier, they're just that fun team to watch. You know, just like you talked about the early Chargers, the 70s, you know, Air Coryell teams. Mm-hmm. But you know, Warner, this guy that comes from bagging groceries to throw into these outstanding, you know, was it Ricky Prohl, Isaac Bruce, and Torrey Holt? You know, those stuff, you know, Marshall Faulk in the backfield. Oh, who could not hate him? Dick Vermeil as the coach. I mean, who could not love these guys? And Isaac Bruce is probably the most likable of them all, you know?
Dick Vermeil, who at that point was the oldest coach to ever have appeared in the Super Bowl, just got beat last year. He also had the longest gap between Super Bowls of any coach. I don't know if Belichick beat that. I think Belichick went like 12 or 13 years at one point. You had to like Vermeil. And also, you know, Marshall Faulk. Marshall Faulk was another example of a guy that, you know, the Colts cheaped out on. Because they had a great reputation for that before Peyton Manning. You know, this was the team they cheaped out on players like the old Los Angeles Rams used to do. That was another great example. And, you know, just wasn't appreciated. And so he decided to, you know, set all-purpose yards records for the Rams instead.
Well, it worked out for the Colts, though, because they drafted Edger and James, who also just went in Canton at that same time as Isaac Bruce did. So it's, So it worked out for both of them in that deal. So
Of course. Yeah. Good move. But yeah, I mean, again, like those Greatest Show on Turf Rams were fantastic. Isaac Bruce, probably, you know, the best wide receiver among, you know, an all-star receiving corps. And again, just killed it in that Super Bowl. So.
Yeah, when did he have enough balls in the air to catch 15,000 yards with all those hungry hands on that receiving corps, you know?
I don't know
how they got him the ball that often. Wow. Right. 91 touchdowns, 15,000 yards, went over 1,000 receptions. Yeah, quite a career he had.
It's Arena League ball.
Right,
NFL.
Definitely his.
Except in the NFL.
Right. Yeah, well, that's where Warner came from. That wasn't he with the Barnstormers of the Iowa Barnstormers? I think that movie's coming out soon. That might be one for your movie one.
Is it really?
They're having a Kurt Warner story coming out real soon.
And, okay, I hope they don't try and sneak it past us as a Christian movie. It's got to be. I'll tell you, it's got to be better than I just finished watching The Replacements again. Figured I'd give that another shot. Nope, that was his bad.
I love that movie.
Really?
That movie's got one of the greatest lines of all times.
Okay.
I love it, and I forget the actor's name. It was Eddie Albert who's playing the owner. I think it was Eddie Albert.
Yeah.
He says, I've seen better fights or better aggressiveness at monkey shit fights at the zoo. That's the greatest line ever. Sorry, kids, that you're listening, but that's one of the greatest lines ever.
Blip that out when you do this podcast. Oh, man. Okay, well, we'll have a little talk after this podcast. I don't want to put the listeners through my rant on that, but no, it is not a good movie, kids. It is not. After this, it almost feels like this list becomes a personal preference thing, at least as far as the receivers go. I don't know. Do you have any other favorites here? I was kind of looking at Irving Fryer, but.
Yeah, I mean, Irving Fryer, Rod Johnson, Andre Johnson, they're all sort of in that same realm. But I mean, I have a good Jack Butler story for you, though.
I know you've been dying to talk about the Steelers guy, so.
Jack Butler played his whole career in the 1950s with the Steelers, who had horrible teams.
Yes.
But they had some pretty decent defenses. You know, 1952 in particular, they had their best cornerback was a guy named Howard Hartley. And actually, Jack Butler came in as a defensive end. That's what he was drafted as. And the guy opposite of Howard Hartley got hurt. and the backup got hurt. They had nobody else to put out there on the field. So the coach at the time said, hey, I know you're a defensive end. Go out there and play cornerback, you know, or whatever, or maybe safety, some kind of defensive back. The guy spent the rest of the season picking off a pass in – he had like 6 interceptions in the 12 games. So every other game he's picking off a pass. Him and Hartley, the second season together, you know, 1951, they had in a 2-year span, 24 games, they had 26 interceptions between the two of them. So yeah. Both at, you know, opposite side cornerbacks. That's pretty formidable when your cornerbacks are picking off, you know, 1.1 passes per game. So I just thought it was amazing. This guy was a defensive lineman when he came out of college. And in the middle of the season, hey, you're a defensive back because we don't have anybody else. So get out there. Wow. And the guy made the Pro Football Hall of Fame. That, I think, is an amazing story. I can't think of anybody else that I've heard that to be such drastically different to your positions.
Well, a smaller game, simpler game at that time, right? A lot more athletic game in the backfield there, I guess. But, I was going to say, I wasn't sure where you were going to go with that story. I thought you were going to tell me that Hartley got Wally pipped. You're going to tell me he never got his job back.
Hartley, I think, played. I think he just faded into obscurity the rest of his career. But, you know, Butler, definitely, there's stories. You know, Butler would – they'd have, like, he'd be up against the best receiver on the other team. And, you know, of course, you could give shots down the field then and not get called for it. You know, wide receivers got beat up back in the 50s all the way through the 70s. Oh, yeah. And Jack Butler was just ruthless on these guys. He would just pound them, you know, into submission. By the fourth quarter, these receivers didn't want to go out for passes anymore. So if it came down to the line, not that the Steelers won games, but
They're the anti-Air Coryell Chargers, right? So
right.
They're not going to allow any points, but they're not going to score any points either. So,
right.
So,
that's right.
I mean, for me, the thing that sticks out is, I mean, it speaks for itself again, is, you know, he made 4 consecutive all pro teams on, you know, again, like not exactly a star studded Steelers team. So, you know, that's,
yeah. And that alone is only like 14 teams in the league at the time, or 12, right, or whatever it was. But yeah, but still, you know, that's the area he played in, and he played well enough to make it to the Pro Football Hall of Fame. But
right,
I don't know that he's. I'm not saying I'm going to put him on our top 10 list. I don't know yet. He's got an outside chance, but I think there's maybe some players that we could talk about that might be more deserving. So, but I just wanted to make sure we mentioned him because I think he's a good one.
Well, the other guy from the era is Len Ford, right? Is that who you're thinking about? Is he more worthy? Okay, because, you know, actually a similar trajectory. He's just playing with a much better team. You know, again, I alluded to this earlier. He's a 4-time All-Pro like a Butler, but, you know, he's playing on those awesome Cleveland Browns teams. And but that's later. He actually started in the All-American Football Conference, right, with the Los Angeles Dons, still one of the great all-time team names in football. But then he wore number 80. I wanted to point this out. He was a 4-time All-Pro on those awesome Cleveland Browns teams, but he was 3 of those years in number 8. So if there's any like borderline discussion here, we got to commit. He was a 3-time All-Pro, number 80. Len Ford was.
Right. he wore 50 and 53 his first 4 years. In the 50 with the Dons and 53 his first 2 seasons with the Browns. But 1952, that's when the NFL, after the AAFC got absorbed in 1950, they said, hey, these guys, you know, Cleveland and San Francisco and this Baltimore team, they're coming in wearing all these crazy numbers. They're messing up our whole scheme. Okay, we got to set the law down.
Is that the story?
Here's... Yeah, so you know, interior linemen are 50 through 79, and wide receivers are this up until this last couple of years where they changed everything around. Now they can, you know, they'll be able to wear number 11 and number 1 and everything on the outside. So, but that's why they changed, everybody changed their numbers in that era, 1952, because the NFL laid the law down.
Did Len Ford make the 53? I didn't listen to the 53 episode. Did Len Ford make the 53 team?
I don't think he made our top 10 of 53 because he only wore it for 2 seasons.
You gotta put him there.
Yeah, yeah. I think Len Ford is deserving to be on that list.
All right.
Six seasons with it. So.
And we should point out too that he was the two-way player early too, and he's getting he was wide receiver and he was getting 1,000 yards a season as a wide receiver in the early 50s. Yeah, so pretty good, pretty good. I'll take him.
Okay, so we'll put him as our seventh. Now here's a guy, another one that's sort of in that Butler range that I'm not sure, and that's Tom Fears. It's our last Hall of Famer.
Yeah,
Tom Fears. Played on those great L.A. Rams teams that had Norm Van Brocklin and Bob Waterfield at quarterback. Crazy Leg Hirsch was the wide receiver opposite of him. They had, who was the back? Smith was his last name. Was it Vinyl Smith or something like that? He had a crazy first name, but good back. But their offenses were prolific back in the 1950s when Fears played and Crazy Leg Hirsch. And Fears was sort of, I think he outled Crazy Legs Hirsch even in receiving yards every year. He was the top receiver on the Rams during those years of the most potent offense in the NFL at the time. Mm-hmm. So I think he's kind of an odd one that we need to think about here a little bit, because that in his era, in a 12-game season, put up some pretty good numbers. A couple thousand-yard seasons, that's tough to do in 12 games.
Yeah, exactly. Like like our boy hang on a second. Yeah, like our boy Len Ford. Fierce is a guy I know through tabletop football. And not much else, to be honest. I haven't read much about him or anything like that, but I remember playing with him in tabletop ball. He was on, again, those great teams of the 50s. So he came, the all 50s team set or whatever that I had. And I believe he was also in the way, way old days of Madden, but they had all time players that you could play with as well. He was also in there. And, it's funny because in the Madden game, they converted to like modern style. So he was all geared up in the modern outfit and everything. He was like this little guy compared to like the modern guys, but he could still catch like a modern guy. So I'll tell you, he was awesome in Madden. I never saw him in real life, but he was fantastic in Madden NFL. So yeah, I if Fears is an all-timer that I'm playing with as a kid, yeah, I'd get him on here. We've got a paucity of defensive players on our number 80 list anyway.
Yeah, and Vitamin Smith, that's the guy's name I was trying to, not Vinyl Smith, Vitamin Smith.
Vitamin,
I think that's one of the, that's
yeah,
a great, Vitamin Smith, great back.
How could I forget?
Had a pretty good offense going on there. Okay, so that, if we're putting Fears on then as our eighth?
Sure, I like
okay. Okay, so now we got to make some choices here. We're getting out of the Hall of Fame realm, because we put eight of them in, and we still have some decent wide receivers like we talked about. With the Rod Smiths, Andre Johnson, Irving Fryer, Donald Driver is on that list. Tony Hill, Chris Collinsworth. There's some good ones in there to choose that all had some longevity wearing number 80.
Well, you brought up, the Peyton Man of the Year Award before.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, if you're going to bring in contributions outside the actual playing field, I love Chris Collinsworth. I love Chris Collinsworth's play-by-play stuff. And one of the things I don't like about these guys who go into play-by-play, Dan Fouts is another one, is that you have to do this thing where you put down how good you were. Now I don't know if this is the Reggie Jackson effect, because I don't know if you remember when Reggie was doing baseball. He would do baseball for ABC once in a while, and he was always like, "If I were hitting it, I'd do it like this." He was always better than the other guys. Mm-hmm. So nowadays it's like you got to be worse than you actually were. But Collinsworth was great. Collinsworth was a great receiver. He played in two Super Bowls. Many years during his career, he's on a top five passing offense in the NFL with the Cincinnati Bengals. I mean, you know, people forget because in the 21st century, they haven't done much of the 21st century. They haven't done much of anything. But back in the day, and this was a Super Bowl contender. They played in two Super Bowls. They had the Niners on the ropes, right? Until Montana.
Twice, yeah,
until Joe Montana mm-hmm. saw John Candy. You know, they had him on the ropes. They had him on. And I think I'm going to test this theory because I have to research this for an upcoming Goats episode. But I have the theory that Collinsworth is the one that popularized that story. I think he's the one that heard that story and started telling it to everybody. And I think that's why that story is so popular now about John Candy. But I just love Collinsworth as a guy in the booth so much that I want him on this list. So often, play-by-play and color commentary are fields where you only talk about the guys if you hate them, like if they suck. Like you rarely go, oh my god! Like the other one is not Troy Aikman, but Tony Romo.
Tony Romo.
Tony Romo is the other one where people talk about them positively, you know, because mm-hmm. they're so much better. It's kind of like a domination thing. They're so much better than the standard. Blah blah blah. I'm giving nothing to this game. And so in that respect alone, I want Collinsworth on this team. I just love Collinsworth.
I like him as an announcer too, but let's look at him compared to some of these other guys, okay?
Okay.
So Chris Collinsworth, he's got just under 6,700 yards, 36 touchdowns in his career. Irving Fryer, if my stack thing comes up on here, Irving Fryer has almost 13,000, almost double the yardage with 84 touchdowns, double the touchdowns, 851 receptions. Rod Smith played a little bit later than those two guys. He had a little over 11,000 yards, 68 touchdowns. Andre Johnson, a more modern player who just recently hung up, over 14,000 yards, 70 touchdowns, 1,000 receptions. Donald Driver, another one that has just over 10,000 yards receiving, 61 touchdowns, 743 receptions. I don't know that I can honestly say I would put Carter over those four guys, especially Fryer that played sort of in the same era as him.
Well, these things are subjective, aren't they?
I knew I had to get your goat.
This is not
double pun there.
This is not truly the GOAT. I'm not taking this seriously. Like I say, I mean, yeah, you know, I mean, the other thing too about Collinsworth is he only plays eight seasons. But you know, again, I think, this is a lot of he just didn't want to take the punishment anymore. You know, it's not a situation where he was done. I mean, again, he bookended his career with those Super Bowls. Right, his first season and his last season, he's going to the Super Bowl. So it's not like he had nothing left in the tank. I think he just wanted to leave with something in the helmet, you know. In all seriousness, I'd probably go Fryer a lot because, you know, Rod Smith, Andre Johnson, Driver, the stats are similar, but Fryer's mm-hmm. a bit more longer lasting. And in fact, Fryer is a very interesting career because he was, you know, a very steady presence for the Patriots in the mid 80s to early 90s. And you know, he's playing almost every game, but those weren't really big play teams. I mean, even those wonderful Tony Eason teams, one of which made the Super Bowl to get fumbled by the Bears. You know, they just weren't break the game open teams, and they weren't huge play teams again. But then he goes on to play a few years in Miami. He goes to play on a few years in Philadelphia, and he's actually getting better statistically, you know, in an offense that was, you know, more designed where maybe he was the number one option. Well, he was the number one option in New England. So he's just getting a lot more looks in Miami, in Philadelphia. And, you know, in his late 30s, he's getting some of his best season statistics. So it just kind of goes to show, again, like, to bring it kind of full circle, Fryer is a guy. I mean, imagine this guy in Walsh's system. I mean, this guy was great already, but then if he had had a big-name quarterback, if he had had a freewheeling coach, this guy might have had some real proverbially gaudy numbers
right
in the NFL.
Yeah, true. So
if I have to be 100% right, serious, it's Fryer.
Okay, I would say Fryer too at the ninth. Now, for the 10th, I'm going to throw a name we haven't talked about yet. Okay. And that's Andre Bad Moon Rison. Show these numbers out. Five Pro Bowls, one All-Pro, Super Bowl championship, over 10,000 yards, 84 touchdowns, 743 yards. I mean, he's right in there with those numbers of those other guys with Driver and Andre Johnson and Donald Driver, Rod Smith. He's right in there with them.
But he's not all 90s team, huh?
No, I don't think so. Yeah, he's not all 90s team, but he has a Super Bowl ring.
Yep.
And you know, five Pro Bowls, that's pretty big. And he didn't wear 80 his whole career, but he wore it for 11 of the 19 or 20 years that he did play. So a substantial amount of time. He was Indianapolis and Atlanta. He was wearing the number 80 in Cleveland.
So. That's a scintillating pick. I kind of like that. I'm kind of looking at this. Man, it's got to be some kind of pain and suffering award for Troy Brown. How many times was this guy released and cut by the Patriots? And I mean, again, you talk about a guy where it's like, hey, you want to play another position? This guy was a two-way player for the Patriots.
Right. Yeah. Hey, we lost our first six defensive backs. Can you go in and play? We know you're exactly a wide receiver, but we're throwing you in there. Yeah.
And again, like Troy, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't he the one that made that completely fantastic last second hit on the Charger defensive player and save the playoff game for the Patriots against the 14-2 Chargers? I believe he was.
He might have. He could have been.
Yeah,
been.
I think he was playing receiver at that point, and the Charger picked off a Brady pass, refused to go down, which is now we know it's what you're supposed to do, and then just Brown hit him in the football, and it came loose. And the Patriots got it back, and damn it, those Patriots won again. It went to the Super Bowl. I'm pretty sure.
In 2004, I think that was that first year, I think that was the first year, or maybe the second year that Brady won the Super Bowl. Troy Brown had three interceptions, playing wide receiver, and he was a wide receiver. Mm-hmm. A starting wide receiver had three picks.
Right.
Yeah,
so Brown, there's an injury, and plus, he was the guy too that in those 2000s, every year he would get released by the Patriots, and then they'd pick him up again and sign him for the minimum. He'd come out there and be the Swiss Army knife for these guys.
I think he was a substantial player, but I think he's sort of like a Collinsworth. His numbers were almost identical to Collinsworth: 6,300 yards, 31 touchdowns, one Pro Bowl. With three Super Bowl rings.
Three Super Bowl rings, right.
Yeah, right. That's a little different than Collinsworth.
But, right, exactly. And played for about twice as long. Played for twice as long.
Yeah, right. But, I don't know that we can put him, that I could sit right putting him on there either. He'd be right up there with putting Collinsworth ahead of some of these other guys.
See, on these lists, I got to tell you, this number 10 ends up being like, you know, number 12 on Team USA basketball. You know, like number 10 is the Victory Human Cigar of these Who's the Greatest to Wear the Jersey Number podcasts. Seriously. And that's why I always want to put, like, you know, the token guy at number 10. I don't want to go the best guy. I want to go the most interesting guy at number 10.
But I hear you, but we talked about these interesting guys.
Yeah.
So I think it comes down to, in my mind, Andre Rison, Donald Driver, Andre Johnson, or Rod Smith? I think it's got to come down to one of those guys based on what we have. I don't see anybody else that compares. I don't think a Tony Hill, even though, you know, great player, I just don't think he has the numbers. I'll take a peek at his numbers here real quick. 3 Pro Bowls, Super Bowl championship, 8,000 yards, 51 touchdowns. I don't think he's on par with those other guys. Even the guys of his era, you know, Irving Fryer, you know, blows him out of the water.
Yeah, what's the case for Smith? The 2 Super Bowl rings?
He's got the 2 Super Bowl rings. He's got over 11,000 yards, 68 touchdowns, 849 receptions. You know, 3 Pro Bowls. I think that's...
I got to say, I'm kind of stuck with Fryer. I like Fryer as yet another...
Well, Fryer's a given. Well, Fryer's got Fryer on. We're trying to choose... Fryer was 9. No, we're trying to choose number 10. That's what I'm saying. I think it's almost... I almost think it's a four-horse race. Rizin, Andre Rizin, Andre Johnson, Donald Driver, Rod Smith. I think it's a four-horse race, and... I'm sort of leaning towards Rizin.
Yeah.
Because I think he's an interesting story, like you said, but he's got the numbers to back it up, and the guy could ball for a little guy, you know?
Yeah. You're going to break my brain on this otherwise. He's got the one ring. This is going to break my brain. Let's go with Rizin. Let's go with Bad Moon Rizin.
All right. Bad Moon Rizin. Okay, so that is our top 10 here. Let's go through it again here real quick. Jerry Rice, Kellen Winslow, James Lofton, Steve Largent, Len Ford. I'm sorry, I jumped down. Chris Carter, Isaac Bruce, Len Ford, Tom Fears, Irving Fryer, and Bad Moon Rizin. So, hey, we did it. Not too many bumps and bruises getting out of that, but... we did it. So I appreciate you coming on and helping me out with this, because this is a tough one. And I know you enjoyed some of these players.
It only got tough at the end.
Yeah, that's for sure.
No, I just want to say thanks for letting me come on and do the Jerry Rice thing. I take this kind of thing way too seriously, but I'm on a one-man crusade against recency bias. I really am. I mean, the fact that when we start talking about goats, when you really start getting serious about goats, you got to look at the peers, right? This is why somebody like, to me, Johnny Unitas is a more compelling goat argument than Tom Brady. And Johnny Unitas had passing marks that stood for like decades. And Tom Brady, meanwhile, is passing off the all-time passing yardage thing week to week with Drew Brees. And, you know, back in the day, Peyton Manning. I mean, you know, there's no – like Michael Jordan is another example. There's just nobody that compared with him at his time. You know, and my boy, Don Bradman. There's just nobody that's of his peer. Lawrence Taylor, like we talked about. There's just nobody on his level. And you know, to me, that's – Jerry Rice is a generational player, generational athlete in his sport.
I agree.
So just thanks for letting me come on and talk Jerry Rice. Jerry Rice is a GOAT Hall of Fame. Truly the GOAT's Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm.
All right, Oz. Well, thank you very much, and we will listen to your multiple programs that you're on Sports History Network, Truly the Goats, Sports History Network Showcase, and the game. What's the game?
Game film.
I'm sorry about that. So, yeah, game film. So make sure you check out Oz and Aaron Davis on that, and Oz on the other shows with many of our Sports History Network podcast people, which we have some new ones coming up, so we'll have some new showcase episodes coming out soon, I'm sure. So we're looking forward to that. So Oz Davis, thank you once again.
Thanks.
We're taking a peek over at the chains and the down marker. It's 4th and long. We're going to have to punt the ball and get on out of here, but we'll have another series tomorrow for your football history headlines, so be sure to tune in. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. PigskinDispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast. PigskinDispatch.com is a proud affiliate of the Sports History Network, the headquarters of sports yesteryear.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Each week, the official Football Learning Academy podcast will take you deep into the history of pro football through interviews with players, coaches, or administrators in the NFL, as well as interviews with Pro Football Hall of Fame selectors, authors, and historians. You'll learn how the game evolved and important moments that shaped the sport into what it is today. And don't miss the Pro Football History Nugget of the Week. Listen to the official Football Learning Academy podcast on the Sports History Network.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.